Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
Welcome to the show, Don Johnson, Timory Millington. Very special segment today because we are joined by the one and only Trent Horn. And now, of course, Trent and Timory, you guys go way back,
hearts and minds,
many years. Tell us a little bit about that and, Trent, what you've been doing since.
Right. So Timory and I, a few years ago, started Hearts and Minds, a show where, especially having commentary from young people, being able to show how we can spread the Catholic faith and comment on current events and reach people both head and heart to show that the Catholic faith is relevant to everyone's worldview. And we did that for a while. We had a good run and, you know, things started to go in different directions. I currently live in Phoenix, Arizona, work for Catholic Answers Remote and have a lot of projects on my plate, writing-wise, speaking, debating. And of course, Don, you know what Timory's been up to,
yes.
radio-wise. And so that's been very good. And one of the projects I've had on my plate that was finished and has come out a few months ago is a new book called Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love.
This is such a treat because I remember talking about this as we were closing the show together. And now it's come to fruition. And I think even more so since we finished Hearts and Minds, the last couple of months, I think people struggling in their faith right now, I think has really hit a whole new level. Even people who have been well-formed and who need to continuously come back to, why am I Catholic? What are the basics? From talking about the Pope, the resurrection of the body, you name it, this book is phenomenal.
I do want to talk about some of the specific topics, but first, Trent, as a guy in apologetics, you and I are both in apologetics, have been for a long time. It seems like if you were going to take a cynical look at it, like, oh, another Why We're Catholic book, right? But
right.
It isn't that. Trent, start with that. What makes this one unique in the genre?
When I go and speak at conferences, at parish events, when I'm out and about, people always come up to me with this request. Do you have a book that I can give to my son who went to college who doesn't go to Mass anymore? Or my husband's not Catholic, but he's thinking about being Catholic. What's a good book I could give him? So right at the outset, I wrote Why We're Catholic, not necessarily for Catholics, but for non-Catholics. Because I racked my brain. You're right. There's a lot of books that explain the Catholic faith, you know, Catholic apologetics. But I realized none of them were really written for a non-Catholic to read. They could assume the reader's Catholic. They might even have an attitude of superiority, like, look how great we are as Catholics. It's not a great book to give a non-Catholic if it has kind of that superior triumphalist tone to it.
That's a great point. In fact, my book, How to Talk to a Skeptic, is specifically written for believers. And I get that question all the time, Trent. Well, do you have something that I could give to my unbelieving friend?
That's right.
And this is that book.
Well, and it's factually based. And I think that that helps many people when we look at different topics on Catholicism. You have many different approaches from personal witness and so forth. But my little sister was actually staying with me when I was going through the book. And she started to pick it up because I said, I want to see your thoughts as I'm preparing for the interview of what stands out to you. And she ends up going through piecing one piece at a time. And she goes, can I have this? It's so fact oriented. It's incredibly educational. And even the design, I think especially for our short attention span, it helps because it's broken up very clean cut without just being a, you know, page at a time read, essentially.
There are hardly any pages that are just blocks of text. So I wrote this book to have a broad appeal, the broadest, here's why we are Catholic. You could give this book to an atheist, a Protestant, a Jewish friend, Muslim friend, a fallen away Catholic doesn't believe in some church teachings, or Catholics can read the book and learn these things in a different way and be reinvigorated to explain them. And so I wrote it, once again, for a broad audience. So it's written, I don't use a lot of jargon or technical terms. I try to write in easy flow. The chapters are short. They're only about 5 or 6 pages long. There's little boxes and stories throughout. Like, I pepper stories of the saints in each chapter, you know, to reach people who some people like an argument, other people want to hear a good story.
Yes.
So the goal, is to make it a broad appeal you could give to anyone. And that's why we actually offer the book in bulk. People can get 20 copies for $60, or they can get it $3 a copy. And I know regular people who just buy it and give it away.
Which is ridiculously cheap for a book.
For a book, yeah.
That is really a great deal. Shop.catholic.com?
That's right.
All right, so we're talking with Trent Horn. His new book is Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. Trent, you don't start by saying why we believe in the church or why we believe in Jesus or any of that. You start with why we believe in truth. Why'd you start there, and what's your answer for that?
Well, as I said, the book is for a broad audience, so I don't know who's going to pick it up. So if you imagine how I'm presenting the gospel, presenting the Catholic faith, think of it kind of like a funnel. So a funnel starts really broad at the top, and then it gets narrower at the bottom. You know, so you want to catch a lot of things that are coming in. So at the broadest point, I realize if we're going to show the Catholic faith is true, people have to see that truth is real. Some things are objectively true. Religious claims have an objectivity to them. They're not just mere preference claims, like you pick a religion like you pick a flavor of ice cream. It doesn't matter as long as you like it. Well, no, I argue in the book it's more like picking medicine. You don't pick the medicine that tastes the best. You pick the one that actually will cure you. And the same was true for religion and its objective truth claims. And so then from there, I narrow it down more, building up the fundamentals of the faith to God, Jesus, the Bible, the church, and specific Catholic teaching.
I love where you talk about the resurrection of the body and a story you tell about a dream you had.
Oh, yes, about my friend who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So halfway through the book, so the beginning half of the book is kind of, you could even call it why be Christian, you know, why believe in God, and then why believe in Christianity? And my answer is because Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and you can trust what he has to say. And so why believe that he rose from the dead? So I talk about the evidence for that, for the resurrection of the body. And I spoke about, people will say, oh, maybe the apostles hallucinated the resurrection. And I recounted, I'm sympathetic to that objection, because I had a friend who passed away very suddenly. I gave the eulogy at her funeral. And, you know, when I found out she died the next night, I had a dream where she sat at the foot of my bed and we were talking and I held her hand and it felt really, really real. And then I woke up and obviously it wasn't. But if I saw her on a continual basis during daytime hours, I would begin to wonder. But I would go and check her tomb, and if it was empty, I'd have cause for, you know, alarm, so to speak. But what I show with the case for the resurrection is that the apostles, we can't say they merely hallucinated, because they saw the risen Jesus in groups. And just as a group of people can't have the same dream, they can't have the same hallucination. And there's good evidence Jesus' tomb is empty. And that, if you think you're hallucinating, that'll snap you back to reality. But just to show that the resurrection of the body is something real, something we can believe in, and we can believe in it because Jesus rose from the dead and he represents the first fruits of the resurrection.
The concept right after that of the Trinity causes a lot of people issues. I saw somebody using a fidget spinner the other day to talk about the Trinity.
That's not a good analogy. That is almost as bad as St. Patrick's clover. That is not a good analogy.
What's a better way to think about it, Trent?
Well, it's hard because the Trinity is something radically unique from all of existence, just as God is radically unique. Analogies are always going to fall short. The best visual depiction I've ever seen of the Trinity, I think it's called the Athanasian Shield. So it's just a diagram. It shows three circles, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and just little descriptors that say, is God, is God, is God. In the middle, it says one God, and then between them, the Father is not the Son is not the Spirit. So
they're connected in the center as well.
Yeah. So the idea, there's different analogies. The better analogies are one like St. Augustine in his writings on the Trinity compares the Trinity to the mind and how the mind can form a perfect image of itself and know itself. And that's actually somewhat closer, but then it becomes difficult for people to wrap their heads around that analogy. So if the analogy is hard to understand, then you need an analogy for the analogy. And right. So what I try to say is, well, look, we believe there's one God. There is one God. And I try to get people to see. People have problems with the Trinity because they think the terms being and person are synonymous, that a being is a person and a person is a being. And so then it gets hard, like, how can there be one God and three persons that's one and three at the same time? So I show people, no, being, you have to understand the terms being, person, and nature.
Mm-hmm.
Being refers to that you are, existence, to be. Being is that you are. Person is who you are. Or that you have relations with other persons. You can form relations. So being is that you are. Person is who you are. And nature is what you are. You know, you fish nature, you swim. Human nature, you think rationally. So what is God? Well, to go back, there are beings that are being – they exist. They have a what nature, but they don't have any person. There's beings that are zero persons, like a rock, a tree, these microphones, and other non-human animals. But then there are beings that are one person, like, you know, human beings. You are a being, you exist, you have a human nature, and you're a human person. That's the who. You have a that you are, who you are, and a what you are, and the one of each. Now, for God, God isn't a being. God is being. Mm-hmm. The reason anything exists is because God just is existence. And so we don't have to ask who made God, because God, by nature, he is existence. Mm-hmm. So God is being. But God is not one person. God is three persons. If there can be being that are zero persons, being that is one person, why can't there be being that is three persons? And that makes sense, as I say in the book, how if God is love, then if God is eternal love, then he will exist as an eternal relation of three whos. Because love is about love shared between the lover and the beloved.
It's a community.
Yeah, exactly.
Community. We can't be in isolation and just love ourselves.
Right. And to understand that that doesn't mean that God is three gods, because we have one infinite being, being existence without limit. That is God. Persons, we have three persons here. And so, and what I try to do in the chapter, as I say, the goal of the book, break it down as simple as possible for people to understand and make it practical in their lives to come to understand who God is.
That's why I asked you about it, Trent. I always appreciate simple yet profound explanations of doctrine, and you do that in this book. We're talking with Trent Horn. The book's called Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. We will be right back with Trent after this break. Stick around.
From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Don and Timmery, applying timeless principles to today's hottest topics.
So before the break, we were talking about the Trinity being existence. I think some of the hardest things to talk about. We're joking that, of course, that would be the question that we would ask you on air. And it makes me think of a story when I was studying theology in school. I remember Dr. Michael Barber talked about how he was, you know, really young. I think he was about 17, and he was teaching these confirmation classes. And he thought, you know, oh man, I get to go and teach. You know, he's right around their age, but you know, he's thinking of himself as kind of older and ready to teach, and they don't know how old he is. And he gives this whole lecture on the existence of God and keeps talking about how God is being. And what ends up happening at the end is one of the students comes up to him and essentially says, wow, that was really profound. I didn't realize that God was a being. and it was one of those moments that was both humiliating, humbling. You're just kind of having to sit here and realize it's not always easy to communicate the Trinity. And even our own language can be a roadblocker for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's hard. When you look in the Catechism, especially around paragraph 40 through 44 and paragraph 42, the Catechism makes it clear that because God is so radically unique from creature, the Creator is not the creation, our language always falls short of the mystery of God. We can only talk about God, really, what he is not, and then we can use analogies. So we can say, well, this is like God. God is like this for us as human beings to understand. And we can understand certain concepts of God, but ultimately that's the task of theology, is to use our human language as tools to reveal the mystery of God to people in different ways for them to understand. And that's what I tried to do in the book, both in the beginning of who God is, how he revealed himself in Christ, and then how Christ gave us his church, and how to make that understandable. Every chapter I wrote, I actually read aloud to my wife after I wrote it, just to make sure. Because the goal here is not to write a big tome or write for the academics. I just wanted something you could give it to anybody and they'd say, okay, I see where you're going here. And that's the goal and why we're Catholic.
Well, you do a fantastic job. If I may, I'm going to give you another tough one. So one of the big struggles for me coming into the Catholic Church was the priest abuse scandal. You, I'm glad to say, took a chapter out to say we believe in spite of scandal. Yeah. Can you give us a brief response to that?
Yeah, I think when responding to the issue of scandal, whether it's the clergy abuse scandal or any kind of scandal in the Church's history, people will bring up things like the Crusades, the Inquisition, and essentially they're making, you could call it the argument from scandal, that if the Catholic Church has a divine origin, then lay people, but especially clergy, would not be involved in grave sin. Therefore, the church does not have a divine origin. So to respond to that in the book, I show, one, there's a problem with that thinking in general. And number two, a lot of the facts are wrong when people talk about the scandals. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we respond to the scandals, people bring them up, we go straight for the facts and say, well, no, you're getting your facts wrong. It's not really that bad because there's this, this, and that. And that kind of looks a little skeezy.
Yes. It ignores the harm that was done.
It does. And so what we should say is this, what was done, if here is what happened, that was gravely sinful and wrong. You're absolutely right. And those held responsible, whoever they may be, even if the Pope mm-hmm. were involved, it could be shown to have been involved in an abuse, in the abuse scandal, or involved in abuse, I would say the Pope would need to be brought to trial and punished, possibly imprisoned, or whatever he would deserve. Doesn't matter who you are. But I say that just because Catholics are involved, some Catholics fall into grave sin, doesn't mean the church is not founded by Christ or that God does not exist. I use the analogy of a hospital. Let's say you go to a hospital and there's a doctor there who engages in malpractice, hurts his patients, maybe he even abuses his patients. And you say, this is ridiculous. I'm done with Western medicine. I'm never going to a hospital again after this. And you say, well, that is terrible. That doctor violated the oath he took as a doctor to do no harm. That was wrong. But that does not mean the hospital itself does not have what will cure your bodily ailments. So the same thing we'd say of the church, that there will be Catholics. And I make the point in the book that if the devil exists, who is he going to try to lead into sin the most? He's going to try to lead the clergy into sin and want people to reject the church for that reason. Mm-hmm. But just because some Catholic leaders will fall into sin, it doesn't mean the church does not have the cure for what ails our souls. So to continue the hospital analogy. So putting that out there, and another way I would summarize it is this. You don't leave Jesus because of Judas. Say, look at Judas, what a terrible person. I'm done with all this apostle stuff and Jesus stuff. Well, yeah, Judas betrayed Jesus. Doesn't mean we should leave him. And so I do that, and then later I go in the book and say, once we've established that foundation to understand scandal does not disprove Catholicism, then I say, well, let's look at the facts, like with the abuse scandal. And I show that this is not a uniquely Catholic problem. This is something you can find in other Protestant denominations. It could be even far worse in public schooling. And yet people don't focus on that because I find, though, many people who bring up the abuse argument, even in journalism and things like that, they're just happy to get a battering ram against the church. And so that's something – but we should start with everything I led up to, but – we shouldn't ignore that and say there are maybe ulterior motives in when people discuss this.
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent element. And I think, too, you started by saying recognizing the harm that's been done rather
yes.
than entering into a factual response. It disarms people.
Yeah. And that way they see you're not just some kind of used car salesman, that I believe in this. It's true. And I hate scandal. I hate when people sin and make things look bad. I mean, that's any of us. Yes. I mean, if a member of your family is arrested for a crime or is found to be guilty, you feel bad inside. But then if people won't talk to you anymore, it's like, well, I didn't do that. That's mm-hmm. not fair. It's important, though, to acknowledge harm and not merely circle the wagons, because that's what Jesus would want us to do. Because he knows, Jesus said, I came not to call the righteous, but to call sinners. Okay? And even after we become Catholic, even after we experience conversion, there will always be the temptation to sin. And some people, the Bible says, will fall away later. And so that's why we must always pray for perseverance. And for those who fall away, be honest and mitigate the harm their scandal causes to others.
We have just a couple minutes left. Before we go, I would love to hear from you. What section in the book do you feel like you most intentionally wanted to communicate to people who are looking at Catholicism or struggling with it?
Well, I think a few sections. The most important ones for me, I think, one, I wanted to show a factual basis for believing in the historical reality of Christianity. This mm-hmm. is not merely a preference claim, not merely a God out there I make in my own spiritual image or spirituality, but that our faith is historically rooted in the resurrection. That can be known. And from that, we can see the church's growth from that. So to show the historical reality of our faith. And then number two, I think later in the book, I really wanted to show that the Catholic teaching on sexuality, on marriage, is not bad news, but it's good news. It's something that we can rejoice in when we properly understand it. Because I knew those chapters would be some of the biggest stumbling blocks for people.
And
that's why they're actually near the end of the book, because you need to see the foundation. The church is true. I can trust the church will lead me to happiness and salvation in Jesus Christ. And to show that these teachings are not antithetical to my happiness, they make me a whole and complete person.
Well, and at the heart of that argument, and this actually takes me back to your background in pro-life work, is fundamentally the dignity of the human person and yes. how at the core, the resurrection of the body, our sexuality, all of that plays into our eternal purpose, essentially, and recognizing that and every encounter we have.
That's right. Absolutely.
If you could summarize the sexual teaching of the church to an unbeliever, what would be their biggest misconception, you think, and how would you – elevator pitch.
Sure. And what I would say is the church's teachings on sexuality are not a bunch of no's. Rather, God has made us human beings, body and soul. And so we can communicate truth with our bodies just as we can with our words. We can also lie with our bodies. And so there is an idea, a real and true idea, that you can love another person, give your whole self to them, so much so you can become one flesh and create another person who is an enduring sign of that love, that I fully, freely, and faithfully and completely give myself to you and only you for the rest of my life. And many people, even non-religious people, recognize that that's marriage. They recognize even in secular weddings, we'll have till death do us part in their vows. People know that love is true and good, and God has given us a way to communicate that love, not just with words, but with bodily actions. And so sexual intercourse is the way to communicate that, and much of the hurt in our world, STDs, abortion, infidelity, abuse, comes from using that amazing bodily gift to communicate this idea as a lie or to twist its truth. And that the church gives this to us as a way that when we communicate sexuality in marriage, in the marital act, then we find freedom and joy in that and happiness that God gives us. And we don't have to find shame in our sexuality. Mm-hmm. Whereas many people, when they think about their sexual history, have shame, guilt, regret. That's not something the church wants to give us. And so if we follow the church's teachings, we will find, instead of shame, we'll find joy.
And you're inviting people into faithfulness and permanence, which you
That's
referred
right.
to this idea of how we always have in the vows, till death do us part. People like that part, in fact.
Right. And what's funny is people will say, you Catholics, you make sex a big deal. You know, stop making it such a big deal and say, well, actually, the culture thinks that. For example, why do even non-religious people, if your partner cheats on you, you say, I'm done with this relationship. Really? I thought sex wasn't a big deal. Wait a minute. You can't have it both ways. And that shows, well, why do people do that? Because it wasn't just a bodily action. If your girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife has sex with another person, their body communicates that faithful and permanent idea of love to someone else. It's the ultimate act of betrayal. But it only makes sense if sex has that inherent intrinsic meaning to it that the Catholic Church teaches that it does.
We've been talking with Trent Horn. The book's called Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. Trent, what's the easiest way for people to not only get the book, but find out more about you and what you're doing next?
To get the book, I'd recommend going to shop.catholic.com. It's also where you can order the book in bulk and get 20 copies for $60. You know, get them for your parish, your children's school group. I know people, a guy who bought a case of them, he leaves them in the back of his Ubers and Lyfts for people to find. Yeah. So just get them and pass them out. So shop.catholic.com. And my website, of course, is trenthorn.com. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter. Love to share with people everything I'm doing.
Trent, good to see you as always. That's the best deal on the internet, ladies and gentlemen. That price for that book. So get it right now, and we'll be right back.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DonJohnsonMinistries.org or Timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
Welcome back to the show. Great to have you along today. And a very special segment. I have as my guest Dr. Carrie Gress, who has a doctorate in philosophy from Catholic University of America. She's a faculty member at Pontifex University. She's a regular blogger at places like the National Catholic Register and fine news and opinion sites all over the internet. Dr. Gress is the author of several books, including Nudging Conversions, A Practical Guide to Bringing Those You Love Back to the Church, and her latest, the one I want to talk to her about today. It's called The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. Dr. Carrie Gress, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on with you this evening.
Now, first, congratulations on the book. I just finished it a couple days ago, and it's fantastic.
Thank you.
As you know, us media types, sometimes we fudge it a little bit. I'll be honest, right? You got a lot of book interviews, and you're like, all right, I'll skim. No, this one I read all the way through, and it's very good. So, I mean, let's start with the basics. What inspired you to write this?
Well, if your listeners are familiar with the Benedict Option, I think that's really what first got me thinking about this issue was the Benedict Option talks about different ways that we can deal with Christian persecution in America and around the world today. And so I got to thinking about, you know, John Paul II's life. I had written a book about John Paul II with George Weigel. And in that research, I was able to see that he kind of offers us a field guide to how to deal with Christian persecution because he lived under it for so long. But then the deeper I looked, I thought, you know, it's really Mary that's so behind so much of who he was and that influenced him really on a global scale. So I thought, you know, maybe there's more here. And the more I kept digging, the more I kept finding. And it was just mind-blowing that a lot of the details that I found, just Mary's influence, even on a geopolitical level, which I don't think we think about very often. I know I didn't think about it much more beyond John Paul II, but in terms of what the people that she's influenced and how much just politics in the world have changed because of her influence. That's really what, you know, ignited my imagination and desire to really put this into print as a book.
Well, and we had similar approaches, frankly, to this, because when I saw this book, you may not know this, but I'm a somewhat recent convert to Catholicism and have not been a big Mary person. It's not like I was repelled by Mary, but I thought, you know, okay, you know, I kind of get the whole, what really got me interested in Mary was through John Paul II and then studying some of the sexual revolution stuff. I'm actually working on a doc about the sexual revolution and the era of Russia and Fatima and all of the movement, if you will, towards breakdown of the family and how Mary has been this bulwark, like the warrior against that. So you know what? I want to return to that. Don't let us get too far afield because the notion that she's working in the geopolitical realm was fascinating to me, and I'm so glad that you brought that up in this book. But let's, for those that don't know the Benedict Option, you brought that up first, and I read that one as well. And how does this compare to that? And because it's not like anti-Benedict Option. It's not really any like the Dominican Option.
Right.
It's not really anti any of those options. How does this one relate to some of those other options?
Well, I think it's more fundamental than all of those options. I think really, you know, all of them are referring to a prestigious person or to a great saint or someone that had some great ideas. But I think Mary is, as we know, just as her whole being is a totally different category, given that she's obviously God's masterpiece. And we know just because of her special relationship as the Mother of God, there's a lot more going on than I think than, you know, even St. Benedict could bring to us. And I guess that was what was exciting about it, was seeing the continuity through which she's worked throughout all of the centuries, instead of it just being tied to a particular time and place. So one of the things I bring up in the book is that a lot of times we see throughout history this pattern where there's a certain type of crisis in the church, and then God will rise up, bring up about a certain kind of saint that's antidote to it. So for instance, you've got the church is being choked by riches, and St. Francis comes along, who's the poverello, the poor, little poor man. So there's these kinds of dynamics going on throughout history. So I look at those dynamics. But Mary, I think, especially in the last millennium, because we have obviously much better historical records even from the last couple of hundred years, has been a constant. And so that's why I think it's more fundamental than any of these particular saints who are tied to a particular time and series of events the way St. Benedict is. But that's not to say that someone couldn't be called to something like a St. Benedict Option, where you are led to a kind of retreat or a dominant option or something else where you're called to be more engaged in the world. But I think that's the beauty of it, is that Our Lady will, if we have a devotion to her, if we're working on this relationship with her, if we're praying the rosary, she's going to make it very clear what it is that she wants us to do, and she's going to help us guide us in that direction, just like she did with John Paul II's life, to, you know, live the fullness of who God wants us to become, instead of us sort of sitting there trying to figure it out ourselves. So I think that's really the beauty of it, is that we don't have to feel like we need to sit through all of them and figure out what to do, but in fact she will really guide us and lead us like our spiritual mother, as she ought to.
I had not thought about that before reading your book, that the Greco-Roman civilization at the time of Saint Benedict had particular errors that he was there to fix, right? Like he had to work
right.
in that context. So what are, and I think you make a great case that Mary is perfect for our particular errors. What are some of the errors of our civilization, and then how is Mary appropriate? Why is God using Mary at this time?
Sure. Well, I think we're living in a very unique time where that Satan is really tempting women in a very unique way. I think if you look at what's happening in the West versus somewhere like even North Korea, where you've got, you know, good old-fashioned brutality, and I don't mean it in the sense that it's good, but it's very tyrannical, it's vicious, it's awful. But I think what's happened in the West is we're seeing this very feminine kind of tyranny that many of us are not even aware. But I think if you look at you know, first of all, the staggering numbers of abortions that happen every day, it's 3,000 in America alone. If you look at what has happened to women in many ways, our whole political discourse is revolved around a very a distorted and unhealthy kind of feminine approach to problems. There's gossip, there's cattiness, there's tantrums, all of these kinds of things. And I think at the heart of it really is an attack on women, because of the fact that we are called to be like Mary, because that we bear the image of even of Mary. And I think that Satan really wants to wipe that out, because he knows that there's no mother, then no one's going to be healthy. Then as a culture cannot survive and thrive without mother, and certainly without a healthy understanding of womanhood.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And as I'm studying the history of the sexual revolution, particularly in the 20th century, and just the very clear to me satanic attack on women, that made a lot of sense. In fact, you use the term anti-Mary in
right.
the book. You want to flesh that out a little bit? Is that
sure? Yeah. No. It was an interesting idea that came to mind. I when I was doing my research on this, I was seeing very much. There's always this binary Adam and Eve, Mary and Christ kind of discussion about her. And at one point it occurred to me that you always hear about an anti-Christ, but you never hear of an anti-Mary movement. I don't mean it as an individual, but I mean the way St. John speaks of it in Scripture, where you're talking about an actual movement instead of an individual. Although I think we could all probably think of individuals that might embody the anti-Mary in a particular way, but nevertheless, so it's the idea really struck a chord with me, because I thought this really describes what's going on in our culture. It's a very deeply anti-Marian kind of culture, where we're all the vices of femininity or women have been turned into virtues, and it's kind of diametrically turned on its head. And it was an idea that I thought of. I didn't really think all that much about it. And then I was contacted by some different theologians who said, you know, we've never thought of this. This is amazing. And, so I'm actually writing a follow-up to it now that's coming out next May, just on the anti-Mary, because it's been just a great way of kind of describing what's going on and trying to wrap our minds around, you know, how do we have to know what's happening in a culture before we can really fight it well. And so that's kind of the idea.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I'm excited for that new book already, because, I mean, don't you think the key to all of our, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the breakdown of the family, right, that requires the male and the female to both be attacked in particular ways? I mean,
but I think that's what's so interesting, is that we don't have this pattern. I mean, you can certainly see pockets where women have been attacked in different ways, but to have it so wholesale, I mean, even looking at our media, if you look at everything coming from New York, Washington, D.C., and Hollywood, I can think of maybe five women who are not basically mouthpieces for Planned Parenthood, and it's across the board. It's incredibly hard to find these women that have not, given themselves over to this really as this secular religion of sorts. And I think that's what's fascinating about it, is even just looking at a magazine, or you can't find an alternative discussion about, maybe there are bad things about abortion that we should be paying attention to. These kinds of things are just not raised at all. That those kinds of red flags are just not put up anywhere. And so I think that's what's fascinating about it, is that a lot of us don't even realize how, and I know I didn't realize how thick it was until I really started looking carefully at all these markers. And women aren't happy either. I think that was the other takeaway for me was, I've written another book called Ultimate Makeover, The Transforming Power of Motherhood. And the research for that was interesting because it just proved to me all the more that women aren't happy. The depression's high, substance abuse is high, the divorce rates, obesity rates, all of these kinds of things are showing that women are clearly not happy at this stage. And all these things that we're being promised will make us happy are clearly not doing what they're supposed to do.
Absolutely. We are talking with Carrie Gress. She is the author of a brand new book called The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. And we will be back with more from Dr. Gress right after this.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Don and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Welcome back to the show. I am very pleased to have Dr. Carrie Gress with us. She is the author of a book I highly recommend. It's called The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. Dr. Gress, you talk about in the book how God uses creative minorities. Tell me about creative minorities and how God uses them.
Sure. Well, I used the work of a historian. I'd love to claim the title for myself, Creative Minorities, but unfortunately, it's not mine. But Arnold Toynbee is a historian that is kind of been forgotten at this point. He died in 1975, but he did this exhaustive work on 26 different civilizations and what either led them to their downfall, or first to their arrival and then to their downfall. And he points to this small group of people that he calls creative minority. It could even be one individual and then some followers. But these were one of the ways in which a civilization was actually saved. And he says it could happen through something like, mass media, whatever that might be, in different, much more, medieval cultures. I'm not sure how that would work. Maybe the town crier or whatnot. But nevertheless, he says that the best way that it happens is actually through the type of person we would call a mystic. And this is someone that God leads to some sort of a spiritual desert. St. Benedict's a perfect example of this. He spent 3 years praying, and this individual spends a lot of time praying, sort of dousing themselves in prayer, and then they emerge and they come back to the world, and from that intense prayer, they then bring a series of gifts that are then help the civilization kind of rebuild itself or turn into something new. So the exciting thing about it is we certainly see a lot of a pattern of that with Saint Benedict. I mean, Christ, of course, is a perfect example. Moses, there's all these different examples throughout history. But the thing that I found so hopeful about it is that it doesn't take a mass movement to really change and transform and rebuild a civilization. It takes, small group of people with intense idea that just works for the time and that is obviously God gifted, and that's what really can transform a civilization. So I think that's a nice thing about my book, was I was able to really make it a hopeful message instead of feeling just overwhelmed by the fact that, looking around the world today, there's so much negativity that you wonder,
all right, well,
what really could be good.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I took the same hopeful attitude from it. I mean, basically, if we can become a saint, or at least move on our way towards it personally, we potentially mm-hmm. can have a huge impact, as opposed to we look out and we say, oh, there's 350 million people that are all going astray. How am I going to change all of them? Really, it's about us drawing closer to Jesus. And as you point out, the easiest way, according to some of the saints, to become a saint is through Mary and the Rosary. Am I being too simplistic in that? Or
No, I think you're right on. I think that was one of the things that I saw over and over again, was just that, you know, we have all of these saints who have said as much. And that actually was almost, it got to be funny, because I was doing all this research on Jesus and Mary, and just you get to the point where you think, okay, they've got to be tired of telling us, you know, how many different ways can they tell us? Okay, here's the brown scapular. Here's the miraculous medal. Here we've got this apparition. You know, all of these different ways that they're trying to give us the same message. And there's even one quote from Blessed Alain de la Roche, who I think it was 14th or 15th century, who received a message from Jesus. And Jesus said to him, if only my people would pray my rosary. Christ called it my rosary, not Mary's rosary. And, you know, you can sort of hear the exhaustion. Like, this is really easy. Can you please just do this? This will really make a big difference. And yeah. So I think that was one of the, you know, overwhelming messages too, is like, we don't have to complicate this. This is very simple, and there's so much fruit from it. And I think that's another exciting part.
I enjoyed your section on how the rosary sort of works. And I know that's kind of a weird way to put it, but actually it was very helpful to me, because again, as a convert, you know, as an evangelical, mm-hmm. I looked at that and I'm like, oh, the repetitious prayers. I mean, isn't that just a waste of time? And it, on mm-hmm. one hand, it looks like a waste of time. On the other hand, it looks like it's too mm-hmm. easy. What is the value? Like, how does it kind of work?
Sure. Well, and this is another great discovery, was this work by Monsignor Rotin. He's a Mariologist, and he talks a lot about how the rosary is a bit like a pilgrimage, and that when we enter into the meditations, we never come back to the world when we finish the meditations the same way. Just like when you go on a pilgrimage, you have these sort of expectations and these hopes and these, and you want to encounter God in that. And I think if we can look at the rosary that way, and, you know, this is happening despite the fact, whether we know it or not, but that's the best thing about it, is that we're going to come back to the world something of a different person than when we started, because how the Holy Spirit and Our Lady and all of those mysteries are working in our souls is a real mystery. But if we can kind of concretize it and look at it as a pilgrimage and wait for something to happen, I think that's one of the things that's exciting about a pilgrimage, is we sort of have this expectation, like, something's going to happen. The Holy Spirit's going to move me in a certain way. And I think if we can have that attitude with the rosary, it just brings it to life in a much more dramatic fashion, because then it's not just repeating, but in fact, you know, there might be things stirring that the Holy Spirit is giving you, or different ideas that you put in your head, or you might think of people that you need to pray for that need your prayers at a certain time. So if we can kind of look at it with a sense of expectation, then I think it transforms it dramatically into a totally different kind of prayer.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does work. That's the other thing, right? Like, you don't, even if you don't necessarily get exactly how it works, and I was in exactly that situation. Right. I'm like, I'm just going to try it. I don't really get it. I'm just going to try it. And you know what, Gary? Things started to change, right? Like, I mean, things started to move.
And I think that's the amazing thing about it, is that first step of faith. I know that was the case with when I did the Marian consecration 20 years ago. You know, as a college student, like, okay, I'm just going to try this. I'm not sure what's going to happen or what, you know.
Yeah.
But what can it hurt?
Right.
And, you know, of course, amazing things happen. You know, she's very powerful when we just even open that door the slightest bit and let her work in our lives.
Yeah. Okay, so we teased this earlier. I want to make sure I get to it. You talked about the overarching work that Mary's doing geopolitically. Do you want to just give us a few highlights, just sort of a bird's eye view of history of how Mary has been actively working?
Yeah, well, I think one of the topics that's come up a lot recently is just the discussion of the Battle of Lepanto. People refer to that a lot. You know, Our Lady was really instrumental in Europe being able to conquer the Turks. They were outnumbered. You know, they prayed the rosary the night before. They ended up victorious. Well, I think that was the amazing thing about this book, was just discovering that the Battle of Lepanto was just one of, you know, hundreds of different battles that had those same sort of characteristics to it. We just don't know about a lot of them. And even looking at Spain, I think this was one of the big shockers for me, was realizing, first of all, that Spain had Islamic occupation for almost 800 years, which I had no idea was that long. I knew it was centuries, but not eight of them. But to see that they, you know, for 400 years, the Christians sort of languished under this, like, how can we get the Moors out? How do we get these Muslims out of our country? And what ended up happening was one general started fighting under the banner of Mary. And that was really what, you know, lit the rest of the country on fire, and this Marian devotion really developed into something very dramatic. And the last wars were kicked out in the year 1492. Well, of course, Ferdinand and Isabella, after they went and thanked Our Lady at the other Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is a whole other piece of the story, in Spain, then they sent Columbus to the West. So it just goes back and forth. There's all these different threads that I just kept tugging upon and finding more and more and more. And anyways, as you saw in the book, it all, of course, links back to the Battle of Lepanto in very dramatic ways. But yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, there was one Prince Eugene, who's said to fight with a sword in one hand and the rosary in the other, and just incredible stories of just these different battles. And we don't really think of it more than the Battle of Lepanto, and that's kind of it.
Right. No, it's fascinating. And it struck me that in a culture where we're, you know, seemingly trying to do our best to make all of these warrior women, you know, be, right? All of the women that I watch on TV and movies now, you know, they're all these soldier type, but in a bad way, right? Like it's not in a way that's realistic, where here is the true warrior woman. Like we actually have what you're looking for right here in Mary.
Yes, exactly. No, without a doubt.
Before we close, let's touch on John Paul II just briefly, because you use him as a case study. What was it about his story and his devotion to Mary you think that really was compelling to you?
What we're all drawn to in John Paul II is this dynamic holiness, that he had this nimbleness of spirit. You know, this is looking at his life. At one point, he did something kind of Benedict optiony. He had to hide from the Nazis. So he's, you know, holed up in the seminary there at the Archbishop's residence in Krakow. So he had to hide from people. At other times, he's engaging. At others, sometimes he uses politics. I mean, he's using all of these different tools at his fingertips. And yet there's this nimbleness that, you know, you see in his life, where it's really the Holy Spirit provoking him or you know, providing him with the avenues that are going to be fruitful. And I think that's what's so inspiring to me about it, is just to see this man that lives through so much and saw so much evil, and he didn't end up in a puddle of despair, which I'm sure I would have ended up in a puddle of despair, right, given the things that he witnessed. But no, his faith just kept going deeper. I mean, even just the fact that his vocation came about after his father's died, his mother's died, his family's dead, and he got hit by a truck by the Nazis and left for dead. And it's at that point that he discerns his vocation to priesthood. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. You know, it's hard to get much deeper and darker than, you know, at that stage when, you know, his city's being destroyed and, you know, on and on.
Yeah.
I think it's just that nimbleness of spirit that really is what's draws all of us to him.
Yeah, it's so inspiring. He's my confirmation saint. He became a saint in time for me to come into the church. So, we could go on and on. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. We've been talking with Dr. Cary Gress. The book is The Marian Option, God's Solution to a Civilization in Crisis. It has been a delight to talk to you, Cary. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
This has been Trending with Don and Timory on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Don Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.